From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's been a few weeks now since the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints released a series of essays admitting what most historians had known for decades, that founder Joseph Smith had taken numerous plural wives in the early years of the church. The church's historian Stephen Snow told the New York Times that LDS history is full of stories of faith and devotion, but that these people weren't perfect. So, what are members doing with that message, particularly the fact that Joseph Smith, the most beloved figure in the faith, may have had up to 40 wives, some of them already married to other men, and one of them a 14-year-old girl? Today in the program, we're talking about Joseph Smith's polygamy, how the church is explaining it, and how it's affecting the saints. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The LDS Church must have been bracing for the reaction when they released a series of essays a few weeks ago with the somewhat explosive admission that Mormon founder Joseph Smith had taken between 30 and 40 wives in the early days of the church. Now, this was no great revelation for a lot of people, historians in particular. The LDS scholar Richard Bushman was just one who had laid out this story in his acclaimed biography of Smith, Rough Stone Rolling. In it, Bushman wrote that nothing confuses the picture of Joseph Smith's character more than these plural marriages. But it's fair to say that a good number of rank and file, active Latter-day Saints stayed in the dark about the stories of these marriages, some of them deeply disturbing, the ones where he had reportedly married the wives of friends, for example, or the fact that among his wives was a 14-year-old girl. Church spokespeople have said they're trying to get out in front of the story and provide some context as more and more of the faithful are encountering these stories online. And today in the program, we're talking about Joseph Smith's polygamy and his behavior. We're also going to be asking a representative of the church a little bit later in the program how they're explaining it. We're also interested in how it's affecting active Latter-day Saints and their image of the church and of Joseph Smith. Joining us on the program today is Andrea Radke Moss, who's an assistant professor of history at Brigham Young University in Idaho, joining us from a studio there in Idaho Falls. And Professor Radke Moss, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Patrick Mason is also with us. He's the Howard W. Hunter Chair of Mormon Studies at Claremont Graduate University. He's joining us from a studio there on the campus of the college. And Patrick Mason, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks, Doug.
I just want to point out, it may be clear to some, but both Patrick Mason and Andrea Radke Moss are active members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So I guess, first of all, Andrea Radke Moss, to you first, surprised at all about the essay and just how, at least this is the perception of some, how open they were in telling this story?
Well, I had kind of anticipated it for a while in the context of some of the other Gospel Topics essays that have been released. I knew it was coming. I was perhaps surprised, pleasantly surprised, to see some of the admissions in it, which are things, like you said, that have been known to historians for a while, but not commonly talked about among the lay membership of the church. So there was an element of surprise, but for me, not completely, and perhaps not for Patrick either.
Yeah. So. Patrick, how are you reacting? I mean, pleasantly surprised? Surprised at all at the candor, anyway? What seems to be?
Yeah, I feel much the same way that Andrea does, that I was pleased to see the essay come out. I wasn't surprised, given the way that the church has been dealing transparently with some of the other difficult issues in its past. I was pleasantly surprised at the transparency that it had and the candor about some of the more difficult aspects of Joseph Smith's polygamy and the issues surrounding it. So I think that the essay is a good one. It doesn't talk about everything. It can't, in given the length that it has. But I was pleased with the honesty and forthrightness that it displays.
Who are these essays, and not just this one, but all of the essays that Professor Radke Moss, you referred to earlier? There have been a number of these over the last year or so. Who are they written for? Who are they intended for?
Oh, they're very consciously written for the average member of the church. Definitely to package some of the more controversial aspects of church history in very tight, concise, constructed, very consciously constructed ways for average members of the church to maintain. I feel like all of them try to strike a balance between honesty and candor, but also, you know, the church still maintaining a control over its message, but in a way that average members of the church can assess these, read these, and have them available, whether it's for young missionaries or for families who are trying to teach their adolescent children about these issues, or for seminary teachers. I think it's for everybody.
Patrick Mason, what do you think about that? I there's some question that's come up as to whether or not these were in fact intended for the rank and file. That they're not easy to find. Clearly, this essay has gotten a lot of media attention, but they aren't being talked about over the pulpit, for example. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, that's right. I mean, the church had a delicate problem here. How do you address the questions that some people have and that we know have been driving some people out of the church while not raising those difficult questions for people who didn't have them in the first place? Yeah. And so the essays are on the official church website, lds.org, but you've got to sort of know where to go to find them. They're several clicks away from the main page. As you said, because of the New York Times coverage and other media coverage, people have been able to directly link to this essay on Joseph Smith's polygamy. But some of the others have been a little more difficult to find. I do think the church wants people to read this. It does want it to be a resource and a tool that's available for people. It wants to be able to tell a constructive narrative about some of these difficult issues. I mean, the church isn't shying away from this. It didn't have to write these essays or publish them on its main website. So it does want it to be available as a resource for people, but it wanted to do so without causing doubts and problems for people who didn't have them. So I appreciate the difficult problem that this posed for the church and the way that they ended up deciding how to handle it.
But let me ask you, reading the essay, what is the church really copping to here? Because it doesn't anywhere seem to suggest that Joseph Smith did really anything inappropriate. It was just putting into context what he did do. So does the document, from your perspective, both of you, concede in any way that there was anything inappropriate done by the founder of Mormonism, Joseph Smith?
I think you're right, Doug, that it doesn't talk about this as a sin or a misdeed on Joseph Smith's part. The essay clearly portrays it as Joseph Smith responding to God's command to do this, responding to a revelation that he received very early after the church is organized. It even includes a paragraph talking about how an angel comes and with a flaming sword and threatens Joseph because he's not proceeding quickly enough in fulfilling this commandment. So clearly the frame for this essay, from the church's perspective, is that Joseph Smith, that this was revealed to him. In some ways, it's inexplicable, it's inscrutable, that the commands of God are mysterious. I mean, this is kind of an Abraham and Isaac thing. But that Joseph was obedient to what the Lord commanded. And of course, a lot of people aren't going to share that interpretation.
Right.
And I think it does raise some theological questions. But you're absolutely right. That is the message the church wanted to portray here.
Andrea Redkimas, what do you think? I mean, I guess the question that you're a pretty skeptical question a lot of people are going to offer is that, come on, why blame this on God? This was Joseph Smith, who had this massive ego and probably a fairly healthy libido, and that's the thing that motivated polygamy. Why not just come out and say something like that?
Well, and that's an excellent question. I've grappled with that one myself, and the notion that we either portray this as this essays tend to do as entirely coming from God, or critics who want to respond by saying, well, Joseph was just, this was complete nonsense that it came from God. These were just convenient statements, convenient revelations that he constructed to justify his behaviors, but he was entirely driven by this kind of unrestrained libido. Mm-hmm. And I wish that we could carve out more of a middle ground in how we see this. I wish that we could carve out that a space for Joseph being perhaps motivated by a complexity or a multiplicity of factors. Yes, inspiration as he's struggling with this and working this through himself over a decade. But could there also be elements of secular, earthly, and yes, even sexual motivations for him exploring this very radical institution, revelation, however you want to say it?
Yeah.
And so I don't know that for me, that was one of, not necessarily the criticisms of the essays, but the essays do take a tone of, this entirely comes from God, it's entirely inspired, and leaves not as much room for members who might want to grapple with this notion of a complex Joseph. It's kind of an all-or-nothing Joseph. I wanted to speak, though, to the first question you ask, if this reveals anything new, and I think one aspect of it is, and I think whatever it is, I'm three pages in when it just says Joseph Smith and plural marriage, where it kind of carves out the difference in the types of ceilings, eternity-only ceilings mm-hmm. versus ceilings for time and eternity. And I thought that that was a very interesting approach to this, and one that historians have tried to unpack as well. And what it doesn't come out and directly say, but the essay does concede, evidence indicates that Joseph Smith participated in both types of ceilings.
Yeah.
In other words, they're not saying it, but in other words, that he had sex.
Yeah.
That he had sex with women who were married to other men as a possibility. And so that, I think, is a major, that in itself is a pretty revolutionary concession as part of this whole essay.
So do you have to, if you are a member, do you have to kind of read between the lines in these kinds of statements, because it would be impossible for the church to just come out and say he had sex with some of these women and we're not sure if it was entirely appropriate? I mean, I guess the question is this, and because I wanted to really unpack the philosophical reaction of members here, could the church handle that? Could they handle hearing that Joseph Smith may have coerced women into having sex with them because he said God told him to marry them?
I don't know that the church is, and these statements indicate, I don't know that the church is ready to necessarily go that far at this point. And so I do think there's an element of reading between the lines and leaving it for lay Mormons, intellectual Mormons, whoever Mormons, to discuss this and try to work it out for themselves. And so what we end up with are, as we've seen in the recent weeks since these have been released, we end up with those who are saying, oh, he was a pedophile and he was grooming, and this has shown long patterns of pedophilia, which I don't agree with. But then you also have people saying, especially about the underage women, oh, this was completely normal for the time, this mm-hmm. was completely acceptable. And I don't agree with that either. And so again, are we leaving ourselves space to really explore the complexity of what was really happening there, and the challenges of imposing, and we often say, don't impose our 21st century standards on the past. And some people say, no, we actually should impose our 21st century standards on the past. But I think we should do both. Don't impose them, but do impose some, and find that middle ground of more productive discussions of what was going on here.
Patrick Mason, what do you think about that?
Well, I think one of the things we have to keep in mind, I mean, this essay, it's a historical essay.
Yeah.
And what it's trying to do is lay out the facts as the documentary record reveals it. But what it doesn't do, and what you're alluding to, is it doesn't theologize about it. Mm-hmm. And so actually, there's still a lot of work for the church to do, whether it's the church leadership or whether it's church intellectuals or lay members of the church. Now the question is, okay, we know this about Joseph Smith. We've come clean. We're not going to argue with people about the facts. Facts are stubborn things, and so we're not going to argue with people about that. Now the question is, what does it mean? Facts do not necessarily compel you to certain conclusions. People can see the same thing and disagree on what it means. And so now the work of the church is to think about, what does it mean did Joseph Smith engage in this? What does it mean that Joseph Smith had sex with other men's wives? On that point, I mean, the essay is a little obscure, partly because the documentary record is not fully clear about this. I mean, people didn't write in their journals, "I had sex with Joseph Smith today," and so we have, you know, we can make some conclusions, we can, you know, connect some dots, but we do have to speculate at some of these junctures. So I think really the question before us is, how does the church create a theology that makes sense of a fully human prophet that engaged in behaviors that, especially from our perspective, and let's face it, from an 1840s perspective, people mm-hmm. weren't so hot on this either. Yeah. There were a lot of dissidents, and there were a lot of people. This is one of the things that started to tear the church apart and one of the factors that eventually led to Joseph Smith's death.
I want to come back to that question because I think that is the critical question, but let's get this on the record, which I think you both have. There were things the church left out in this essay. Patrick, you've mentioned the coercive nature of these relationships was something the church didn't exactly come clean on.
That's right. I mean, as good as I think the essay is, there are some things that it doesn't deal with. I think partly it may be a matter of length, but there are some things that are tough to talk about. One is that in many of these marriages, when he approached the women or when he approached the husband, there was a coercive element where he said, essentially, your salvation is on the line. Your soul is at stake here. And if you reject this, you're going to go to hell. And we do have a number of documented instances of that. That's, you know, that looks a lot like spiritual or ecclesiastical abuse. The essay mentions but doesn't fully wrestle with the fact that Joseph Smith and the others who practiced polygamy in Nauvoo, they were doing one thing in private but saying another thing in public. They publicly right. denied this. The statement, the essay says they offered carefully worded denials. Others have seen this. I mean, it's really more a matter of duplicitous statements, misleading statements, outright lies.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, right. And the essay doesn't fully engage with that. And there are other things as well. But for me, those two issues are things, again, that need to be dealt with in greater detail.
Andrea Radke-Moss, the essay points out that most of the women that Smith married were between 20 and 40 years of age. But it does mention, right. of course, and we have to bring this up, Helen Mar Kimball, who was the daughter of two of Smith's close friends. Here's how the essay put it. It says that he married her several months before her 15th birthday. Now, that has to be the most conspicuous and clumsy sentence in the essay.
It is.
She was 14.
No question.
Yeah. So what do you make of that?
Why equivocate on that? I'm not sure how that one got past an editor, but she was 14.
Yep.
She wasn't just 2 weeks, she was going to turn 15. She was 14 years old. And so I think that it's exactly those kinds of wording statements in the essay that maybe indicates back to what you had referred to, that readers have to kind of read between the lines, or there's a way that the church is still trying to kind of package this in really palatable ways.
As if her being 15 would completely be fine.
Right. somehow being 15 is okay because she's, yeah. exactly,
but wait,
Patrick.
But put that in context, though. I mean, the church does actually come out and say, look, and this was a reference to something that Professor Radke-Moss, you were mentioning earlier, it was technically legal at the time for girls of that age to be legally married.
Yes, but the challenge is that this still was not common. Yeah. A 14-year-old girl marrying a 38-year-old man would have been completely anomalous. Mm-hmm. This would not have been normal. A 14-year-old girl maybe marrying an 18-year-old young man would have been more normal. So to say that just because of her age it was normal, it takes out the fact that he was almost three times her age. But at the same time, we need to be fair. Often Helen is portrayed as the kind of case in point of his pedophilic tendencies, which I also think is unfair. There was a lot more going on there that I think that I do think we need to get at the root of. One is that her parents knew about it, approved of it, which, I mean, frankly, that could be troublesome.
Yeah.
That her parents are passing off their oldest daughter to the man that they adore and revere. But at the same time, I believe that her parents did consider this dynastic, similar to how he was also referring to his other marriages, that this was a way that you are going to be tied to me in the eternities. This is a way that we'll all be connected into these larger kinship networks. And this is a way for the Kimball family and the Smith family to be eternally linked together by sealing myself to your oldest daughter kind of thing. And so we do need to find a fair space for that. And we also, I mean, adolescence was a little different back then, but we also need to be careful not to say, oh, this was normal and 14-year-old girls were getting married all the time
in the
1840s.
But be honest with me, do you buy that he was trying to find some sort of eternal familial connection to those he loved around him, therefore he was going to marry their wives or their 14-year-old daughters? I mean, do you buy it?
That's a good question. You know, and in some ways I do, because in some of the marriages very much indicate that, and the language he used to talk about it indicated that that was his goal, especially when he's marrying women almost 60 years old. You can assume that there's not as much of a sexual attraction for him there. But it comes back to the point I made earlier.
Yeah.
Can we read Joseph's motivations as singular? Can we just say he was entirely motivated by this one thing? I don't think we can. I don't think you can take out the sexual aspect of this. I don't think you can take out that many of the women he approached were young, single, attractive women. But you also can't take out the fact that quite a few of the women were widows and were over the age of 35. And so again, I don't want to pin down on one thing or no. I'm going to say I don't buy that that was his entire motivation, was just to link everybody in these big kinship patterns. If it were just that, why would he have had sex with young women? If it were just about linking families together.
Yeah.
And if the purpose of polygamy as stated in Jacob chapter 2 is to raise up seed, why have sexual relations with people that don't produce offspring?
Well, that was the question that came to me. Did he have children with anyone except for Emma?
Well,
that's
a complicated one. We really the historical record is really, really shady on that. And Patrick, you can probably speak a little bit more to this, but you know, they've tried to. They have a handful of people saying that this I had a child, or this was an offspring of Joseph, but they've not been able to document any fully. They've not been able to do any DNA testing, to my knowledge, to show any. So no, we don't have entire populations of descendants of Joseph Smith walking around, you know, Cache Valley today. Not to our knowledge.
Patrick, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, the scholarship that I've read on this is that there's been some genetic testing done to look at some of these things that I think, if I remember right, goes along the male line, the Y chromosome, and there hasn't been anything conclusive there. Apparently, I'm not a genetics expert, but apparently it's harder to test on the female line conclusively. So there are these reports. Where people say either I am or my daughter was, you know, one of my children was came from Joseph Smith, but in some of these cases it is hard to tell, because oftentimes these came from women who were also married at the same time to their regular husband, so that there's some inconclusiveness about whose child these are.
I want to get to that question, Patrick Meeson, that you raised earlier about what Mormons now are to do with this information, now that it's out there in a very public way. But we need to take a break first. We have Patrick Meeson with us, professor of Mormon studies at Claremont Graduate University, and Andrea Radke Moss, a history professor at BYU Idaho. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about how Mormons, active Mormons, are coping with the news that Joseph Smith practiced a very active life as a polygamist. Recently, the LDS Church has acknowledged in a series of essays Smith took as many as 40 wives. Some of them were already married. One of them was only 14 years old. And we're exploring now, what are members to do with that information? Let me read a few reactions that we've been getting. This came from KM, who writes, I'm a lifelong member of the church, meeting all the benchmarks along the way. After the release of the essays, for me, it's been if what was previously called anti-Mormon propaganda or what others previously had been excommunicated for now turns out to be true, I can't help but wonder what else are they not telling me and what else happens to have truth behind it. Ben writes, to be fair, I've known about this issue for years, but I was told it was an anti-Mormon lie. I'm personally not hurt by the essays, but they are not new revelations. But I do find it extremely disingenuous to pretend that people should have known. This seems like an institutional problem, which will hopefully be corrected. Mariana writes, although the church is still putting a nice shiny package on the issue, which is understandable to do, she says, I respect them for trying to come clean. Angela writes, the church has now taken a stance, and that stance is to justify polygamy completely, which is a pretty reprehensible thing if you're a woman. Let me read one more from Phoebe, who writes, I think most Mormon women are not comfortable with the thought of polygamy, either in the past or in the future, the afterlife. That's the reason I personally didn't look into polygamy or church history any further than my church lessons on Sunday. I understand the argument that it's not necessary to focus on topics that might be uncomfortable for some people, but keeping information from members because it might make them feel uncomfortable is lying by omission, and that is wrong. So while getting a sense of a couple of reactions there, Andrea Radke Moss, let me just get you to react, since it was one of the things that Phoebe mentioned and Angela too, is this idea of the church hasn't entirely disconnected itself from the concept of polygamy. In the afterlife, there is still technically, conceptually, the idea that a man could be married to more than one woman.
That is correct. And that is a challenge for the church even today, as they continue to insist in numerous public statements. You can even go back to famous interviews with Gordon B. Hinckley and Mike Wallace and Time Magazine and some others, where there's this complete insistence, we do not practice polygamy anymore. The challenge is that the church hasn't really done as much as they can to complicate that message. Certainly we don't practice polygamy in an earthly setting, and there's an effort there to distance the church from the practices of various fundamentalist groups there, and that's very consciously done. But theologically, we absolutely do still practice polygamy. I myself am a second sealed wife to my husband, whose first wife died of leukemia. These are realistic, day-to-day lived issues for a lot of LDS members, faithful members, who are, even if you're not part of the kind of maybe progressive Mormon crowd or the critical or the intellectual crowd, a lot of lay, just really strong, long-life, believing, faithful members really struggle with this. They struggle with the fact that there's an unknown aspect to what they will be expected to do in the next life. And certainly there's a common kind of, well, don't worry about it, the Lord's going to take care of it later response that tends to be the kind of typical response. But for many people, that kind of falls short, and that it rings hollow, those types of answers. And so I agree with Patrick that somehow these essays should prompt us to think more carefully and thoughtfully about what is this theology, and do we still accept this theology? Do we believe this theology did come from God? And if we do believe entirely that this theology came from God, then what impact does that have for us current members who face this as an eternal reality?
It seems like one of the questions, and Patrick Mason, I know you're writing a book about this, how do you get Mormons to stop thinking of their leaders as superheroes, as people who are infallible, as Joseph Smith, however you spin this story, clearly was in the circumstance of his plural marriages? And will modern Mormons follow a fallible prophet? Patrick Mason, what do you think?
Well, I think fallible prophets are all Mormons have. It's all anybody has. Yeah. They're human beings. And
but do Mormons, do mainstream, active, temple-going Mormons really believe that?
Well, that's one of the questions. And I think for a lot of people, it's hard to conceptualize that. And there are statements in Mormon scripture, there have been statements by Mormon prophets and others that sort of tend towards a kind of infallibility. But I think the lion's share of the evidence and statements from Scripture and other things, I mean, the Doctrine and Covenants, which is the collection of revelations given through Joseph Smith, I mean, over and over and over again, it talks about Joseph Smith's sins. I mean, if Joseph Smith wanted to construct a doctrine of infallibility, he was really bad at it. He did a bad job of covering his tracks theologically. Yeah. And so I do think, you know, one of the issues that Mormons have now is they don't see the prophets and apostles of the church up close and personal.
Yeah.
Back in the 19th century, everybody knew that Joseph Smith and Brigham Young were imperfect because they saw them in town and they saw them as regular human beings, but then they also regarded them as people that the Lord worked through and gave commandments and revelations through. But nowadays, in a global church of several million members where people never see the prophets and apostles except on TV, it's easy to mythologize those men and to regard them as something as through their calling that somehow God has endowed them with some kind of superhuman abilities that removes them from the sphere of human fallibility.
But I wanted to ask you about, and I want to get Andre Radke, I want to get you on that, but let me just sort of give another bit of context here, because if you look just back to October, the October General Conference of the Church, you have a number of talks. One, Russell Ballard gave this talk where he urged members who were facing challenges like crises of faith, his words, or doubts, to stay with the church, stay in the boat, as he put it. That was the title of the talk. The boat was his metaphor for staying in the church despite those doubts and other challenges. Mm-hmm. And in the talk, he said this. He said, leaders of the church will not and cannot lead you astray. And he said, here's his quote. He said, those who have become lost or confused are typically those who have most often forgotten that when the leaders of the church are united, it is the voice of God for that time. And then he quoted this Mormon scripture that whether it be my own voice or the voice of my servants, this is God talking, it's the same. So you've got that, and Andre Radke Moss, you've referred to this Neil Anderson, he's another member of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles for the LDS Church, was kind of digging in. Henry Eyring seemed to be digging in. None of them conceding or talking about the fact that they're imperfect vessels, but that there's the voice of God. So it seems like it's a very mixed message you're getting.
I want to speak kind of to what Patrick was saying. Sometimes today we tend to view them as kind of these righteous automatons, almost robotic figures that sleep in their suits at night, and then they pop up in front of the pulpit. And I don't think Joseph himself would have been comfortable with even how members talk about him today. I think he would have been discomforted by perceptions of infallibility and that he was without failing or without sin. I think that the church leaders, I think that they sense that they're in a transitory period right now where members of the church, and if there is a kind of widespread crisis of faith that is happening, which is documented in numerous places, if this is happening, the leaders of the church are, on the one hand, they're torn between having to concede some of these historical challenges like they've done with the Gospel Topics essays, while at the same time reaffirming to members of the church the importance of sustaining and of staying in the church. And that's an interesting tension. And so I don't know that any of those speakers that you mentioned, I don't know if you were to sit down with them on a one-on-one basis, that any of them would deny that some of the things that we're talking about here. But in their public messages, they have to kind of maintain this narrative of, but we want you to still follow us because we're doing our best and we're trying to, you know, we're leading the church and we're not going to lead you astray.
Well,
comes, though, when you go back in the fact that multiple prophets were blatantly racist that led to the priesthood ban.
Yeah.
There's a question there. Were we led astray on that? That's a difficult question. That's a really difficult question, and it comes back to these essays. Is it possible that the church was led astray on polygamy as well? That's a question that many members have, and many historians have.
Yeah, but
if
the church
come back to that.
But the church isn't saying that. The church is pretty unequivocal here. They're saying, no, this was a commandment, Smith. And not only was Joseph Smith following the commandment, God sent an angel with a sword to tell him to get cracking on on this commandment. So the church seems to be pretty clear, does it not?
Yes, the church, I mean, like I said earlier in the interview, I don't think that the church is going to back off from that interpretation of polygamy, that it was formally
from God. Yeah.
But where was I going with my thoughts?
Well,
let me give it over to Patrick for a second.
Well, I guess here's what and Patrick, this is what I want to get to. If the church is saying, if it's sending messages from its leaders from the pulpit, when we speak, it's like God speaking, at least when we speak under the inspiration of the Holy Ghost or whatever, or when we're all united, and when they're saying in the essay, yes, Joseph Smith practiced polygamy, we're going to cop to that, but this came from God. How are Latter-day Saints really supposed to then reconcile that reality if the church isn't completely coming out with it?
Well, I think this is one of the struggles that the church is going to face in the 21st century, is how to deal with that. This is a paradox. This has always been a conundrum and a paradox in Mormon theology. Arguably, the two most important principles in Mormon theology are agency on the one hand and obedience on the other.
Right.
And those two principles are in tension with one another. But for the most part in Mormon theology, it's a healthy and constructive tension, although we don't always recognize or acknowledge that there is a tension. And I think we're seeing that here. How do we think about the fact and this belief, this core belief that God calls prophets, that he called prophets anciently and they produced scripture, he calls prophets in modern times and they produce scripture, that is the word and the will of the Lord. But at the same time, he does so through fallible human beings, and repeatedly, these prophets also tell the membership of the church, you've got to get your own revelation to know if what we're telling you is true and from God. All of those things are in tension. They're all paradoxes. But I think that's what gives life in many ways and vitality to Mormon theology. It's precisely where those things rub up against one another and create some conflict, some friction that we see, I think, some interesting but hard possibilities in Mormon theology. That's what we're going to have to grapple with over the course of this century.
If you go back to Nauvoo itself, if you go back to who Joseph was introducing polygamy to, and the essay doesn't deal with this aspect as well, as the number of women who told him no, who said, you know, like Sarah Granger Kimball said, go teach it to somebody else. Hmm. And even though he's using language of kind of threatening, coercive, if you don't do this, you'll be damned kind of thing, but a number of women, even though he used some of that language and was holding that over them, they still said, sorry, I don't want to do it. And so do we have any predictions of whatever happened to these women? Many of them stayed in the church. They went west. They were active members of the church and leaders in the Relief Society. And so refusing Joseph didn't seem to be the death knell for their future progress in the church. And so even at that time, we have to allow that there were women that were exercising agency in whether or not to embrace this or to tell him, no, I'm not going to do it.
Hmm. Andrea Radke-Moss is a history professor at BYU, Idaho. Patrick Mason, a professor of Mormon studies at Claremont Graduate University. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug.
When we get back from a break, we're going to hear from a representative of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We need to take a quick break first. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about Joseph Smith's polygamy, how the church is explaining it, and how it's affecting the reaction from the saints. Joining us now on the program is Richard Turley. He's an assistant church historian, recorder for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, joining us by phone from his office at the Church History Library there on Temple Square. Richard Turley, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here, Doug.
I guess I want to know first, why did you decide to write an essay like this and be so candid? I mean, there are some critics who say you left some stuff out, but why be so candid? Is the church losing members because of this?
You know, statistically speaking, I don't think there's any concrete evidence yet that the rate of people coming out of the, leaving the church is any greater as a result of this than it might be at any other time for any other reason. But the times that we live in now are times in which people have a lot of information available to them on the internet, and therefore discussions about many of these topics are going on that may not have gone on in the past simply because people didn't have as much access to information.
Right.
You know, institutions like the church face a challenge on topics like this because Latter-day Saints today do not practice plural marriage as they did in, say, the 19th century in Utah. And there is a lot of confusion in the world at large between the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and some of these polygamous groups that continue to practice plural marriage today. And so there's a need to distinguish between those groups that are practicing plural marriage and that have often been in the news for often highly sensational reasons.
Right.
And in order to make that distinction, you don't want to overemphasize the church's polygamous past for fear that people are going to confuse you with the present. At the same time, you want to be open and transparent about it. I think the very fact that you've got this show and you've got active Latter-day Saints on talking about this topic is a good illustration of our desire to be open and to have this topic be discussed. It would have been very easy not to publish these essays, but our feeling was, let's give people some information that they can deal with.
It says in the essay, let me quote it here, that God commanded the adoption of plural marriage. So you're pretty clear there. This was God's idea. This wasn't Joseph Smith's idea. The official position of the church is that this came from God.
That is the official position of the church. Now, I'm a historian. I'm not one of the church leaders. I'm a historian. And so for someone like me, the answer to the question often comes down to a matter of faith and whether or not in the historical record there is anything that would sustain that kind of faith. And so, as we look at the historical record and ask, why did Joseph Smith practice plural marriage? I think Andrea made a good point in her statement that there can be multiple motivations for marriage. That's true of all marriages. If I say to somebody, any listeners today, did you get married for romantic reasons? I think many of them would say yes. Was that your only motivation? Probably not. In the case of Joseph Smith, his motivations, I think, can be determined in large part by looking at the consequences of his marriages. He was married to his first wife, Emma Smith, from the late 1820s until his death in 1844. He fathered 9 children by her. They adopted 2 others. So this is obviously a young, virile male capable of producing children. Joseph Smith had other wives through plural marriage. We don't know the exact number, although our Joseph Smith Papers project is working on a list that's based on the evidence and the quality of the evidence. But the curious thing about Joseph Smith's marriages to these other women is that we have not to date, in spite of a lot of active research, we have not to date been able to find a single child, a single descendant that we can connect to any other wife of Joseph Smith.
But you don't dispute the fact that Joseph Smith, in some of these marriages, had sexual relationships.
No, we don't discount that at all because they were, after all, marriages.
Right.
And so that, but in terms of the question of motivation, if the principal motivation of Joseph Smith had been a sexual motivation, there should be a tremendous amount of evidence in the form of descendants of Joseph Smith through other wives, and there simply have not been any found. And there has.
But are you also saying that sex did motivate him?
Oh, what I'm saying is that if these were marriages, there may have been a romantic attraction of that, just as there is with any marriage. But I don't think we should overplay that based on the evidence.
Right.
The evidence shows that there simply aren't a lot of little Josephs running around, as you would expect from a man who's fathered 9 children by his, by his principal wife.
Right, right.
And there have been efforts made to try to identify some of those. There are traditions in some families that know about Joseph's ceilings to relatives up the line that, hey, we descend through Joseph Smith. And efforts have been made to test those, and so far there hasn't been any absolute positive match on that.
Yeah.
So when you look at that and step back and look at the larger picture and get to this question of dynastic connection and kinship networks and so forth, it does appear from the historical evidence and the record that we have that there is a motivation that exceeds sex. That is not a principal motivation.
You say in the essay that some men unscrupulously used polygamy to seduce women to join them in this particular practice, spiritual wifery or wifery. Are you at all saying in any way that Joseph Smith, does the church concede that Joseph Smith may have been one of the men who acted at times unscrupulously? Or do you in any way concede that Joseph Smith may have exploited this revelation, may have mishandled this commandment that he received from God?
No, the essay does not concede that. Now, the statement that Andrea made about Joseph Smith's multiple motivations, you know, if in fact you are a believer that Joseph Smith acted by divine decree, and then he got married to somebody, you have to ask the question, well, in getting married, did he have a romantic attraction to the person? And the answer, as Andrea pointed out, was probably yes in some cases, probably no in other cases. But it's clearly not the principal motivation for the practice.
No, it's true, but I think there was some question that came up in the conversation earlier as to whether or not Joseph Smith had outright lied about the fact that he was practicing polygamy and, in some cases, may have, in fact, coerced friends, women into these relationships. Do you want to say something about that?
Sure. First of all, the question of coercion is a very interesting one from a sociological perspective. There has been a lot of discussion about that recently, with some people on one side of the question feeling that what was going on was highly coercive, and people on the other side arguing the statement. Historians, sociologists, and others will continue to debate these issues. There's no question about that. I think that the interesting thing for me from this perspective is to look at the question of whether or not a person who is in a position of respect like Joseph Smith was and then chooses to marry someone who may not have that same kind of position of authority is of necessity coercive in doing that. If you have say, a radio personality like a Doug Fabrizio who is deciding to marry somebody who doesn't have the same public profile that you do, and in the process of your proposals for marriage, cause someone who has lesser status than you to accept that marriage. Is that coercive? Is the language that's used the principle?
Here's the question: did Joseph Smith say to some of these women, "God has commanded that you marry me, and if you don't, you're going to hell"? That's not an indirect sort of sociological impression. That's a direct threat.
The question of whether he said God commanded me to marry, I think that's pretty clear that he does say that in some cases.
Right.
Although we don't, one of the challenges with this entire topic is that the historical evidence is not as clear as we would like it to be. And our Joseph Smith Papers project will go through the evidence and lay it out and explain what happened in individual cases. The question of whether he told them that they were going to go to hell if they didn't practice that's not clear. Yeah. And so, you have the case of a Sarah Kimball, for example, who's invited to practice plural marriage. She does not.
Right.
She rejects him,
yep.
And it doesn't seem to affect her standing in the church whatsoever, and she has, she becomes a very prominent woman in the faith. I think this idea that Joseph's telling everybody that they're going to be condemned eternally if they don't marry him, I think people need to go back and readdress that evidence.
Hmm. I do have to ask you about when Joseph Smith married Helen Mar Kimball. Obviously, she was, and here's the, I'm going to read this again from the essay, several months before her 15th birthday. That's been such a conspicuous sentence structure, Richard Turley. Why not just say she was 14? Do you guys regret that? Was that a mistake, or did you just, I mean, what was the point there?
Well, these essays are committee products.
Right.
And there were those of us who had 14 in there.
Yeah.
And someplace along the editing process, it got changed to that language, which, we all smile at today.
I get it. Okay. So why not? What would be wrong with Mormons viewing Joseph Smith parallel to, say, King David, in the sense that King David had some sexual indiscretion that he had to deal with, and he revealed that in, it's been revealed in Scripture, and he was maybe fallen for a time, but it also revealed that these people are infallible. Do you see any relationship between, if you're not conceding that Joseph Smith did anything inappropriate sexually, I suppose it wouldn't be a direct parallel, but the question did come up, what's wrong with seeing Joseph Smith as having made a mistake, having been driven too much by some pretty base sexual desire, and that doesn't necessarily have to undermine his role as a prophet for these people?
Well, I guess two things. One, the historical evidence that we have does not lead to that as an absolute conclusion.
Yeah.
There, you know, you have people out there who are interpreting the evidence in different ways, as Patrick said, with some wanting to see the evidence as somehow or another proving that he was acting indiscreetly, and others saying, no, if he's commanded of God, he's just doing what he's been commanded to do.
Right.
That theologically, in Latter-day Saint scripture, there's a clear distinction made between Joseph Smith and King David. In the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, you have that clear distinction made. So theologically, there is that distinction made between what Joseph Smith's doing and what David did in the Bible.
I want to sneak in one more question here. Why is the church not publicly announced the posting of the essays? I mean, it's been pointed out that they're not really, it's not that visible on the church's homepage. You have to kind of do a search. You have to kind of go looking for this. And is this getting to the mainstream rank and file members? How do you respond to that?
Well, those of us who helped produce the essays knew that they would be viral, okay? So it's not a question of whether they're going to reach people. We knew they'd be picked up. We knew they'd hit the, you know, the news stories like they have.
Yeah.
So we knew and very much intended that they become public. At the same time, we want to try to avoid the confusion that I mentioned earlier between our church and these other polygamous groups. I was just last month in Korea speaking at a couple of religious studies conferences at Korean universities. And, of course, they have questions and answer sessions associated with that. And, you know, one of the first questions I got was about plural marriage. And immediately the asker of the question confused us with these other polygamous groups, and I had to make, you know, a distinction between them. So you're talking about a practice that, you know, is not current today. And so, you know, some people are saying, you know, let's not spend a lot of time devoting attention and resources to something that we don't practice anymore, and, you know, running the risk of confusing us with other groups. At the same time, there's a great desire on the part of myself and others to be very transparent. And, you know, we do know it's going to generate conversation. I personally think that's good. I think the fact that we can have a radio program like yours with a Patrick and Andre on it talking about it is a wonderful thing and a sign of our increasing desire for openness.
You think this is going to be a deal breaker for some Mormons, this Joseph Smith news?
You know, people are individuals, and they all act on a kind of a totality of their life experiences. So it may be for some. For others, it's not going to be.
That's Richard Turley, an assistant church historian, the assistant church historian, recorder for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, joined us by phone from his office at the Church History Library. Richard, thank you very much.
Thank you for
joining us. We have Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson. We need to say thanks to our good friend and terrific intern, Michael Shea. He's interned with this show since May, and he's great. We're really going to miss him, but he's got to move on to a paying position with a local organization. We wish him the best of luck. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark, and I'm Doug Fabrizio.